Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Are you even qualified to help me? That's the question that author, columnist, and illustrator John Paul Brammer begins his book with. It's a fitting question for someone who gives advice for a living, and one of the many questions Brammer seeks to answer in his new book, Hola Papi, How to Come Out in a Walmart Parking Lot and Other Life Lessons. You most likely know J.P. Brammer from his advice column Hola Papi, which first ran in the gay dating app Grindr, or actually in Grindr's digital magazine, and now runs on Substack. And his debut book reads very much like his column. It's a memoir told through essays, each based around a reader question, and answered in that funny, salty, sometimes gut-wrenching style that's made him such a beloved writer. The New York Times called Hola Papi a masterclass of tone and tenderness. Hola Papi takes us through Brammer's young life as a mixed-race, Mexican-American, queer kid from rural Oklahoma, all the way to his post-college life in Brooklyn, where he currently lives. And here with us today is John Paul Brammer. JP, welcome to All of It.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So you've gained, you know, a robust online following from your Hola Papi advice column, answering questions, you know, from your queer readers with both care and humor. So for listeners who may not be so familiar with your work, how did you end up getting into the business of giving advice?
Yeah, the answer is by complete accident. I was sort of working as a freelance writer at the time, trying to make ends meet in New York City, having been recently let go from my full-time writing job. Didn't want to move back to Oklahoma with my parents out on the farm, you know. So I was like, I have to find something to sustain myself. So I was taking a lot of jobs all at once, a lot of freelance opportunities. One of them happened to be pitching a column to Into, Grindr's digital magazine. And my thinking was, I have limited resources, limited time. I have so many writing projects to do every day. I need to write a column once a week to maximize the number of checks, but I can't come up with something new to write about every single week. I just don't trust my observational abilities that much. What do I do? And that is where the advice column format and I sort of found each other by happy accident. because I was like, okay, gay drama is an inexhaustible resource. I can always have something to write about. They will provide me with the prompts. It's genius. I was like, you know, twirling my villainous mustache. Like, I've cracked the code. It'll be fine. But to compensate for the fact that I had no real qualifications to give anyone advice, I said, okay, but it will be a complete parody. It will be a satire of the advice column format, where the joke is, what if Dear Abby was a gay Mexican man on Grindr? Like, that was going to be the whole thing. But of course, the fact that the column was being pushed on Grindr meant that it went out to a huge global community, people from all over the world. And of course, people on Grindr, if you're on the app in the first place, you might be looking for a sense of connection. You might be looking to just have someone to talk to. An advice columnist, an agony uncle, in my case, is sort of the perfect figure to encounter on that app. So the letters I started getting were really heartbreaking and emotional and personal and intense. And so I quickly discovered I kind of have to take this job more seriously. So the book is sort of about finding myself in that accidental place of authority where I had to sort of reckon with, okay, but who am I to tell anyone else what to do?
Yeah. And this book is structured like an advice column, but it's really about you and, you know, your life. Why did you decide to write it?
Yes. So, you know, growing up, I never thought I can't wait to become an advice columnist one day. And, you know, even now that I'm an adult, I'm still like, you know, I don't see myself as an advice columnist first and foremost. I still see myself as a writer. But the thing about being a writer is that it's hard to make a living as a writer. It's hard to make that your day-to-day existence, which is sort of what I was after. And Hola Papi, you know, this thing that I kind of made up on the fly, ended up becoming my window, my opportunity to be connected to an audience, to get my words in front of other people. And I see that as a very sacred, very difficult thing to get in life. And so I wanted to honor that by making it the basis of my first book. So this book is very much me writing a letter back, for once, to the world, to my audience that I already have, and to people who maybe don't know me yet, because it really has been just the perfect way to meet new people and meet readers. And I thought, why not stick with something that's working so well?
Let's talk about the town you grew up in, Cache. Mm-hmm. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Tell us about Cache.
Yes, you are. Yes. Cache, luckily, it's a pretty small place, very easy to describe. There's like one road. There is a traffic light. It's one of those towns that is sort of was once upon a time a little boom town, but all the stores are now sort of boarded up. Used to have like an arcade, an ice cream parlor, pizza shops. Nowadays, the town square looks quite haunted if you were to walk through it. It was very much a place whose heyday has sort of come and gone. But that does sort of lend it a little air of romance as well. If you were to go through it, if you were to see, for example, Eagle Park, the old little amusement park that used to run and is now sort of broken down and rusted over, there is something kind of interesting there. But yeah, it's very small, very rural, very close to Comanche Nation. So most of the kids in my rural middle school, they were either, you know, white farmers' kids or Comanche kids or Kiowa kids. And then me, the Mexican.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, were there many Mexicans in your town when you were growing up?
Yeah, I kind of say in my book that not only was my family some of the only Mexicans around, we were some of the only people around. It's, you know, my neighbors were cows. Right now it's very exciting because our new neighbors installed some American bison next door. So now when I visit home, I get to see them. Yes, it's wild.
Wow.
But it's very much that kind of environment. You know, it's like plains upon plains, lots of empty space, lots of fields. And growing up there was kind of isolating. It was kind of lonely in many ways. So I kind of had to cook things up with my imagination quite a bit. And that's where I kind of fell into both writing and art, because what else did I have to do?
Totally. And in one of the essays, you answer the question, how do I overcome my imposter syndrome to live my life as an authentic Latino? And you write about your experience feeling like a fraud for wanting to become Mexican. I wonder, in your mind growing up, what did a real Mexican look like and behave like? What was a real Mexican like?
Yes. So, you know, when you're a kid, it's sort of like you think the whole world is just like you. And growing up is the process of discovering that that's not at all the case. And you start looking at yourself in the reflection of the world, and you have to kind of behold yourself for the first time. And that can be very traumatizing, can be very complicated. And for me, that looked like realizing that my abuelos, you know, my grandparents who basically raised me, who I was around all the time, I was just like, wait a minute, these people are considered the other in this country. You know, they had very dark skin. My abuela dropped out of elementary school to do manual labor. She picked fruit, basically. My abuelo was the very first in his entire family to go to college. It was a local college, but nonetheless really alienated him from his family, who wasn't too keen on him getting an education like that. So for me, because my abuelos were so poor, they had so many struggles, that is what being Mexican or being the other meant. It meant struggling. It meant suffering. And when I looked at my life, you know, living in a house with air conditioning, which to me was a huge flex on my abuelos. I was like, because, you know, during winter and summertime, their house was either too cold or too hot, and they would have to come stay with us. And so luxury to me looked like comfort. And comfort, in my mind anyway, as a teenager, sort of separated me from being like my abuelos. And for some reason or another, I think it's the natural urge to want to be a part of a community, to be a part of something bigger than yourself. I felt a strong urge to reconnect with what we'd lost. So that looked like taking Spanish back, which my abuelos didn't teach my mom or me because it had hindered them so much growing up. My abuela didn't speak English when she was in school. So these were things that they did to be able to move lighter through America. And then me coming along later, looking back and thinking, no, but I want those things because it can sort of, it can make me feel better about being who I am because I don't know what I am. And so that chapter is very much me deciding to take a job at the tortilla factory in my hometown and working with a bunch of other Mexicans who I thought could teach me how to be a real one. And, you know, antics ensue for sure.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with author, illustrator, and advice columnist J.P. Brammer about his new essay collection, Hola Papi, How to Come Out in a Walmart Parking Lot and Other Life Lessons. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, in for Allison Stewart, and you're listening to All of It. So, You know, this book deals with so many things, including with questions about identity surrounding queerness and the expression of that identity. In one of the chapters, you write, quote, "I remain open to challenges to my perception of my sexuality and to my reading on my desires. And as we, as a collective, continue to shift the vocabulary around sexual orientation and identity, I imagine that self-understanding will change." Can you expand on that idea?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of my favorite subjects because I'm very much a language dork. I'm obsessed with language, and I find that at the end of the day, it is a very crude tool for understanding ourselves because it's imperfect, because we can never quite perfectly embody any one word. I mean, just like with the word Latino, like, what does that mean? Who does it encompass? Who doesn't feel like they quite fit under it? Because words always, by their nature, will struggle and fail to capture the thing that it is seeking to capture. And so for me, queerness is a lot like that, because by its very nature, it is sort of slippery. It is sort of built in opposition to other things. And so when I think about my sexuality, when I think about my identity, there is an urge, of course, to think of that as a very static thing. Like, okay, I'm gay, and that's sort of the end of the video game. Like, I don't have to think about this anymore. I don't have to accept new challenges to who I might be because, you know, I understand myself. I found my label. But the thing about labels is that they're there to assist us. They're there to help make sense of the world and bring us in contact with other people who might share similar experiences. It's there to help us build community. But at the same time, at the end of the day, it is still a word, and words are going to fail us. And so what I'm trying to communicate with the way we express who we are and what we are is that identities are very much subject to change. They're subject to the shocks and throes of living alongside other people who are also experiencing new things all the time. Understanding shifts, our ideas shift, even our perceptions of ourselves are open to interpretation at any given moment. And instead of being afraid of that, I'm trying to embrace it and really make it part of my foundational identity, because sometimes when you're so certain of who you are, a challenge to that idea might send you crumbling down. And I just can't afford to crumble every time I encounter a new idea.
And I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, how words fail us and just like how things are complicated. So there's this really lovely chapter titled How to Kiss Your Girlfriend. And you write about your first romantic relationship as a kid with a girl you met through MySpace. Her name was Rebecca, and or at least you call her that in the book. And in this chapter, you contend with what could be seen as wasted years spent in the closet and how to grapple with that time lost. And you know what? Reading this really made me think about a conversation I've had so many times, even recently, just the other day, with gay friends in their 30s who do feel robbed of those years in their youth in middle school and high school because they weren't allowed to be their full, wonderful gay selves. But you write that it's complicated. How so?
Yes. I guess for one thing, I would start with sympathizing with that notion, because it is sort of a making lemons out of lemonade situation, or lemonade out of lemon situation, where, yes, it isn't fair that you weren't allowed to sort of express yourself the way you wanted to or inhabit your full self. But the other thing is that no one's inhabiting their full self at that age. Everyone's a mess. Everyone has no idea what's going on. Even if you are a full-fledged heterosexual, you are going to encounter awkward moments. You're going to have mistaken relationships. You're going to have bad experiences. In any given dynamic with another person, it's not like we have a full understanding of ourselves. So I could go out, date a man right now, and that relationship could still teach me new things. I could find things I like and dislike, something I couldn't do when I was a kid growing up and trying to figure out who I was. But the reality is we never stop figuring out who we are. And so what I wanted to do with that chapter was look at this relationship with a girl that I had in high school, one that I had completely written off because, you know, once I came out, I started comparing stories with other guys who dated a girl in high school, and it sort of met with that little bit of laughter, a little bit of dismissal, like, yeah, what was I thinking? Or we have language like, you know, that was my beard, or, you know, I'm a gold star gay, meaning a gay man who's never been in a relationship with another, with a woman. But I found that language kind of flattening and dehumanizing both to ourselves and to the women. And I wanted to look at that relationship and not dismiss it, not think of it as a fake time, a time before I was a real person because I hadn't come out yet, but see it and take it as an actual relationship and say, but I really love this person. We had a lot of warmth to share with each other. We had a lot of lessons to teach each other. That's what relationships do. And so, yes, I don't think it's fair that I was in the closet or that I had heterosexuality imposed on me in that way. But that doesn't mean that relationship wasn't part of my life and didn't hold anything to give me for later down the road.
Yeah, and you make a point that sometimes in talking about those girls who are now women, it's kind of unintentionally cruel in a way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It is very dismissive, and it is sort of like pretending that they don't have the full depths and nuances that you have, that, you know, you were sort of this person with something to hide, and, you know, they were sort of a brief accomplice to that end. But I think it's so much more than that, that you both had desires, you both had secrets, you both had things to exchange with each other. That's what a relationship is, no matter what period of life you're in. And I think that's both beautiful and scary and messy and all of the above, and therefore worth writing about and exploring.
Let's talk about middle school, because you write, quote, "For years, I had nightmares about being back there. Even when my life felt good and my past was behind me, I still felt the profound effect of eighth grade. That time of my life shaped the economy of my emotions." Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that?
Yes. So in that chapter, it's called How to Lose a Rabbit. And it's sort of about me growing up where I did in rural America, being, I would say, pretty much abused by both my peers and my teachers for sort of being seen as effeminate, for being, you know, I wasn't gay. I didn't see myself as gay at that time, but pretty much that's how people saw me, and therefore that's how they treated me. And it was very brutal. And the big symbol for that chapter for me is there was this wall by my middle school, lots of pebbles in it of different colors, and I used to stare at it when I was hiding out from people, and I would find shapes in it, and there was this rabbit that I could always reliably find in the wall. And so it kind of recounts the story of me later in my life having this successful column, working in Freedom Tower, which for me was like a big deal at the time, like having a desk there, and going back to my little rural school. And I wanted to go to that same wall and sort of not only find the rabbit, but find that kid, find that person who was me at the time, who was weak, who was vulnerable, and sort of feel like I had won over it. But when I went back to that wall and I looked at it, I couldn't find the rabbit. And I think what I'm trying to say in writing that chapter is sort of, you know, the stories, the things that happen to us and how we think about them, the narratives we use to capture those traumatic experiences are subject to change. We are constantly changing as people. And so our understanding of our life events, the things that make us ourselves, the way we see ourselves, are constantly shifting. And that doesn't mean that the events themselves, that they change or that they're different now. It's just the way we see them. It's the storytelling element of it. And trauma has a major storytelling element to it. So for me, you know, being abused in middle school when I was very vulnerable, it taught me a lot of lessons about how to survive, what I'm allowed to say and what I'm not allowed to say, how I should look at myself, how I should preserve myself. It pushed me to succeed a lot in life because I didn't want to be that vulnerable. I didn't want to be that small and that defenseless ever again. And going back to that middle school and seeing that wall again and not being able to find either the rabbit or that kid made me realize that that was all just a story I told myself. I was never going to be that same kid again, no matter what I did, because that shouldn't have happened to me. It wasn't my fault. So I just wanted to sort of talk about trauma, the way it impacts us, and that there's an element of creative writing to it that we do have some control over, even if we can't control what happened to us way back then.
I don't know if there are many preteens or, you know, teens who are queer and listening to public radio right at this moment at 12:54, you know, in the afternoon. But if you could give advice to a queer kid going through hell in middle school right now or high school, what would it be, JP?
Oh, there's so many. I have so many thoughts on this because in the act of writing these stories, what I realize is that, you know, queer kids going through hell probably have a lot of advice for us as well. I know that when I was that age, I knew things then that I don't have to know now. You know, being hyper aware of what I needed to do, how I needed to act, what it took to survive. I was very scrappy in that way. And I think that that's really sad, and that's something no one should have to go through. But it did impart me with a way of seeing the world that has made me very, like, much more empathetic, I think, that has made me kind of who I am today. And that's not to say that, you know, the response to bullying is that it builds character, only to say that we often, as marginalized people, have had to develop specific tools to move through this life with ourselves intact. And so I think that one of the more important things to tell a person like that, when they're going through a situation like the one I went through, or even if they're not necessarily, is just that, you know, you've got to find the people, and you've got to find the knowledge, and you've got to find a sense of self that will carry you through to the next day. You've got to be, because it's out there. Because growing up in rural Oklahoma, one thing I didn't know was that there was a world waiting for me. Everything felt very small. Everything felt very closed off. And so if I was just able to impart the knowledge that there is something waiting for you out there with open arms, and it, you'll be able to find it, I would have changed my life.
We're going to have to leave it there for time. John Paul Brammer, his new book, Hola Papi, How to Come Out in a Walmart Parking Lot and Other Life Lessons. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is All of It. Back with more.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.